Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we look back on some of our favorite books of 2019. In studio, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Vicki Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich. Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning.
And joining us from NPR in Washington, D.C. is Petra Mayer. She's editor at NPR Books. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Petra, you helped put together the NPR Book Concierge. Tell us a little bit more about it for folks who might not be familiar.
Sure. It is a giant matrix of several hundred of our favorite books of the year, a sort of visual matrix, and it's searchable by a bunch of really interesting stackable tags. So if you're looking at the Book Concierge, you will see just a grid of book covers, and then down the left side, there's a list of tags. There are things like book club ideas, there are basic ones like fiction or like nonfiction and kids books, and then there's things like funny stuff and for music lovers, and you can kind of click on whatever you want. So say you want a book for your book club, and you want it to be about, you want historical fiction and you want it to be funny, you can click all three of those things, and then the Book Concierge will give you whatever matches those tags with a little write-up from one of our critics, e-commerce information, links to station coverage, links to our coverage, and also, this is cool, links to where you can find it at your library.
Ah.
Excellent. We like that one.
So that's, and the tagging, how do you, I mean, that sounds like a lot of work to kind of figure out all these different categories that a book could fit in.
Yeah. Oh boy, it sure is. We lock ourselves in a conference room for hours on end.
Yeah.
There are several days where we just block off, 4 or 5 hours, and we sit in there and we argue over every single book individually. And it does take a while.
So you get a lot of suggestions from the NPR staff. So how do you whittle that down?
It's a lot of this process is three or four of us locked in a room and arguing about things. That's basically how it works. I think this year we got 700 suggestions.
Wow.
I mean, we solicit them. We start in September and we ask our staff and critics to send us in lists of what they think is interesting from the year. And then it's very subjective, but we kind of try to hammer out a balanced list that includes lots of different genres, lots of lengths, lots of different authors, and we try to sort of hit a little bit of everything.
Right. So this assignment this month, Jill and Vicki, was some of your favorites of 2019. Was this a tough task?
This was a very tough task. Every task is tough for this show, but this was particularly difficult, I think, because I realized as I was looking at everything I had read this year, I don't necessarily read new books. I have a real inclination toward the 19th century. Nonetheless,
you did it.
I persevered, and I actually did read a lot of great books that had been published in 2019.
How about you, Vicki?
You know, it's funny. When I thought that we might have to talk about the best books of the year, that was daunting to me. What are the criteria? What makes a best book? But when we started talking about favorites, suddenly the whole thing became much, much easier for me.
Yeah.
We know what our favorites are. And for me, we have a staff of voracious readers. So really, my list came from our staff and their favorites. So it was a fun task and pretty easy.
Yeah. So, Petra, talk a little bit about best versus favorite, because that's a good way to put it. What makes a best? Yeah.
I mean, it's so subjective, right? I mean, yes. I don't know how you guys operate, but the way that I like to use critics, I guess is the way to say it, is to find somebody whose inclinations match my own and see what they say.
Yeah.
So, whether that's objective, I mean, there are criteria, right? Like, are characters believable? Is the plot well constructed? Is the world well built? Those things are somewhat more objective, but beyond that, it's very hard to say this is the best.
And we see the book reviews, and sometimes we find the books that aren't reviewed at all are really some of our favorites. And
yes.
I don't know, who has thoughts on why do some books get the reviews and others don't?
Oh gosh!
I think Petra would be the one to answer that. I would love to know that as well.
Sometimes it's just as terrible a thing as I didn't notice it in time. Usually we don't cover paperback re-releases, but a couple years ago I discovered Station 11 way after it had actually come out and went, oh God, no, how did I overlook this? It's amazing. It blew my mind.
Yeah.
So that, I think, to this day is the only book we've ever covered in paperback because I felt so terrible that it slipped through the cracks.
Yeah.
I look ahead, I look at catalogs, I meet with publicists every year. We go to Book Expo in New York and we spend days meeting with back-to-back meetings with publicists to sort of see what's coming in the 6 months to a year ahead. But even then, you know, things fall through the cracks. We don't have the capacity. We don't have the right reviewer for a book. Sometimes when that happens, I try to talk one of the shows into taking a book. But there's always going to be things we miss, and I hate it, but that's how it is.
Well, look at how much is just published in any given year. It's tons,
Yep.
All right, so Jill, get us started. What's your first fave?
Well, I have to start with a book that I don't know where I first read about it, but happily I buy books from my library. So wherever I saw this, I fell in love with it, and it will not be surprising. It is called Bibliostyle, How We Live at Home with Books by Nina Frodenberger. I have to say, this seems to be the only copy in Clams right now. There are 19 holds, so I really have to get this book back to the library. And what it is in fact, mostly photographs, but also conversations with people who have the most spectacular bookshelves you can imagine. And it essentially, this is book porn, is the only way to describe it. As Dwell Magazine said, they described it as a dream and drool design book, features some of the most jaw-dropping book collections of homeowners around the world. And indeed, they are from around the world. In the intro, they write, "I've always been most interested in the question of what makes a house a home. What are the elements that move a house beyond its physical structure and provide the warmth that we all crave? In my 15 years as a designer, I've come to understand that the answer is simple. It is about surrounding ourselves with things we love." And clearly the homeowners in this book love their books deeply and have the means with which to create spectacular settings for their books. So, and there are little interviews with each group of people. They talk about how they came to make their books and some of them are very funny because they have couples, of course. There are also a lot of couples in this who have jointly created bookshelves. And as Gay Talese says in his interview, "A shared library may have saved his marriage. Back when we were first dating, we briefly broke up, but we had in common quite a few favorite writers. Graham Greene, Fitzgerald, of course, Cheever, Irwin, Shaw. We didn't have duplicate copies and couldn't bear to give up the joint bookcase." And so bookcases can indeed save your marriage.
There you go.
Anyway, a gorgeous, gorgeous book. It's called Bibliostyle, and it is a book to dream on if you don't have bookshelves that look like the ones in this book.
I will never have bookshelves like that because when I have a good book, I have to give it away. You have to read this. I end up giving it away to somebody.
Well, that is a great way. I should be doing more of that because I have piles of books. So. Yeah.
And never I was going to say, I'll never have a shelf like that because I just have dusty piles all over the house.
Exactly.
All right, Vicki, what's on your list?
I thought I'd start with The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. He was the author of Underground Railroad. This is just a gripping story about a young black boy who, through no fault of his own, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, ends up not going to college as planned, but is sent to basically a reform school. Which is horrendous. It's a horrendous situation. There's terrible abuse that takes place there. What makes it especially interesting, beyond the writing, which is wonderful, is that it's all based on a true story. Mm. This was a school, the Dozier School for Boys down in Florida, I believe, where in 2011 they found a number of graves of boys who had been in this school. So just a gripping read, and one that is a staff favorite, recommended by Fran, Sarah, Elizabeth, everyone.
The whole staff,
The whole staff, yes.
All right, Petra, what do you have? What's your first book?
Almost every year there's a book that I force all my friends to read. And this year it was a book called Gideon the Ninth. So what you guys may not know about me is that I'm a giant nerd. I read a lot of sci-fi, I read a lot of fantasy. I also love romance. So Gideon the Ninth is a sort of... the shorthand description of it is lesbian necromancers in space, but what it is it's a fabulously written sort of it's a space opera. It's a whodunit. There's a little bit of horror. There's a little bit of a love story. It's set in a sort of crumbling galactic empire. There's a distant, mysterious god emperor. There are nine houses that carry out his will, and he summons the leaders of the nine houses to him to compete to become his new, in the book they're called lictors, they're kind of assistants. And so this is the scenario in which the farthest house, which is the ninth house, this sort of crumbling, gothy, gloomy, these are the necromancers. The daughter of this house and her cavalier, who's this amazing meathead named Gideon, she's an orphan who's been raised in this house. She has a very love-hate relationship with Harrow, who's the house leader, and they go off together into sort of mystery and danger. And it's just dripping with style. The writing is amazing. The world building is viscerally good. Like you can almost smell it,
wow.
Which is what I love when I'm reading a sci-fi or fantasy book is, do you believe the world that it's set in? And the other thing that I loved was something that I didn't notice until I was sort of three quarters, almost done with it. In fact, I might've been reading the climactic battle and thinking, wait a minute, all of these characters are women, but I didn't notice because they're not written in any kind of cliched, gendered way. It's just a facet of their characters, and they're all, you know, they're sort of the cliche about the strong female character, and usually it's just somebody who is really headstrong and overly perfect. But these are strongly written characters. You believe them. You want to spend time with them. You're sad when you have to leave them. And I've made all my friends read that book this year.
And who's the author again?
Tamsin Muir. It's Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir.
Great. All right. And we should mention we will have a link to all of the books we talk about, the list at our website, capeandislands.org, later today, not at 10, but a little later on. We'll put it together. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to share your favorite book of 2019. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill?
Well, this is a book that I had been struggling to find a book that I really, really loved from 2019. And then I talked to a friend of mine who is a librarian at Hingham Public Library. And I often like books that he likes. And I was like, you know, Peter, what have you read this year that you really loved? And he mentioned this book. And I had not even heard of this book prior to his mentioning it. It is called The Binding by Bridget Collins. I can't see that it's been on any best of list. I can't see that it... However, once I started reading this book, and I have to say, living in a very distracted world, it is hard now for me to sit down and just go straight through a book. Once I started this, I couldn't stop. And it's basically a story of these two men who fall in love with each other, but more importantly, they are both have their memories, which is called in the book binded, which is to say there is this witch that will take your bad memories. And when she takes your bad memories, she will then put them she will design this beautiful, beautiful book, and she will put it into her library so nobody can touch these again. And she takes your memories, but when you leave her house, you no longer have those memories. And many of these memories, as I said, is very bad. And one of the characters actually finds out that his father has been binding memories of all of the housemaids for some time. And this is because he's been doing terrible things to the housemaids. So there's this sort of track about that. But it's really about what reading can do and what novels can do. And in this particular world, which is somewhere in England at some mysterious time, she's not too specific. There are novels, but people don't want the novels. They want these book memories. And so they start collecting these other people's memories. Anyway, it's quite wonderful. And I couldn't quite figure out why I loved it so much. And then I read this review in The Guardian. I was like, that's it. In which they write, many readers of The Binding will simply sink gratefully into the pleasures of its pages because, like all great fables, it also functions as transporting romance. I once heard an author of young adult fiction being asked what her novel was about, and instead of explaining its adventure plot or sophisticated science fiction premise, she said, kissing. This was clearly self-deprecation, but it was also an aperçoit about the pleasure that draws readers to a huge array of books, from The Hunger Games to Anna Karenina. The Binding is a kissing novel par excellence, and on this level, it is like a wonderful meal made from a few simple ingredients. The feeling in your chest when you hold someone in your arms for the first time, the sight of a host of bluebells. In recent years, the state of the world has threatened to make us forget the simple pleasures of kisses and bluebells and thick novels that tell stories of heartbreak. Here is a book to help us remember.
What a nice
review.
It is. Huh?
And many of the reviews on this were sort of lukewarm because this woman, this was her first actual adult novel. She'd done a lot of YA writing. But I'll tell you, it really, if it grabs you, it grabs you strongly, as it did me. And it's called The Binding by Bridget Collins.
Right. I literally just went and bought it for Kindle while you were talking.
Ha 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 ha!
It sounds excellent. Amazing. You'll enjoy it.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. We're talking about favorite books of 2019. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about favorite books of 2019. In studio with us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, Vicki Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich, and joining us from NPR in Washington, D.C. is Petra Mayer. She's editor at NPR Books. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add to our list of favorites from 2019. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What's next, Vicki?
Oh, it's so hard to choose, but I think I'll go with one of our best-selling books this year, and one that's, again, a big staff favorite and customer favorite. It's called The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek by Kim Michelle Richardson. And it's a fascinating story, just like one of those comfortable, good reads about a woman during the Depression in Kentucky. She is hired by a program. It's the Pack Horse Librarian Program that I believe Eleanor Roosevelt started during the Depression. Women were hired to ride horses out into the countryside to reach homes that were not very accessible and bring books to the people there. And it talks about the importance of books and reading, the impact on people's lives. I think the author just speaks with such knowledge of the area and respect for the people there. Interestingly, the woman who is the main character is blue. And there really were...
Blue as in
as
the
in
color
the
blue.
Color blue. And there were blue people on Troublesome Creek in Kentucky. And
really?
So this brings in the nature of prejudice. And people were prejudiced about these people. It was a family. It was some sort of a genetic condition.
Wow.
In fact, of course, I had to run to the internet and look it up. And there are pictures of people who were blue. So I think that's been intriguing and just a wonderful read. I think it would be great for this time of year. It's The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek.
All right. Petra, what's next on your list?
I'm going to recommend a young adult novel called Gods of Jade and Shadow by Silvia Moreno-Garcia. It is set in fantasy jazz age Mexico, and it is based on Mayan mythology, which is fairly unusual in fantasy. It's a little bit like a Cinderella story at the beginning. It's about a young woman, and she's kind of a drudge in her rich grandfather's house. And then in his bedroom, she finds in a chest the dismembered body of the god of death, and she resurrects him. And they go forth on this journey through the land of death to rescue his throne from his evil brother who's usurped it. And it is, the relationship between them is really interesting because obviously she's immortal and he's a god, but there's this bond between them and she is growing and changing as he is becoming more human because he's kind of leeching off her life force in order to stay in the world. And so not only are they traveling through this fascinating realm that is much more merciless than your basic fairy tale realm, and much more interesting. But the relationship between the two of them is very, and it doesn't go in any of the directions you think it will go. And again, like I said, I'm kind of a world building junkie. To see a world built on Mayan mythology and on the Jazz Age and on Mexican culture is just, it's a wonderful read.
I love that when you think you know where the story's going. Like, wait, oh, mm-hmm. Nope. That I got that wrong.
Sometimes I like predictability, but sometimes I don't. I mean, you know, I also love romance novels, and part of the comfort of those is it's like a roller coaster. You may go up, down, and sideways, but you know there's going to be a happy ending. But sometimes you want a little sting in the tail, and this book definitely has it.
Wait, did she know what she was doing when she resurrected this god of death?
No, I don't think she did. She just found some weird stuff. She found a chest full of weird stuff and opened it up.
It's fabulous. You
know, watch out for mysterious boxes.
That's
basically.
Right.
So yeah, that's Gods of Jade and Shadow by Silvia Moreno-Garcia.
Jill.
The next book I have here is another novel and a very short novel. In fact, one might call it a novella, but it packs a big punch. It was actually, I first read about it because it was one of the books of the year at the Wall Street Journal book pages. It is called Say, Say, Say by Lila Savage, her first novel, which is, it seems, a bit a memoir as well when you read her author's note. This apparently is what she used to do, which is she goes to a home in this case, and she helps take care of people who are very ill for one reason or another. Doesn't sound like a really great read, but in fact, it is so beautifully written that it was another one of those books where I just sat down and I couldn't pull. I essentially read it in one reading, because you can, because it's not that long. The description of it is really, this is what how the New York Times described it. Intimate novel traces the complicated interior life of a young woman who drops out of graduate school to work as a caregiver for a man and his brain-damaged wife. Doesn't sound like a really fun novel, does it? But when you start reading it, you get so involved with her and her partner, Alex, who is a woman, but she doesn't want the family to know that she's a lesbian, so she's trying not to tell them. But she's also become so intimately involved with the couple and their son. And the woman, one of the things she can say is say, which is how the book got its title. But it is also so much about grief and what grief brings you. Here's a little sampling, and Ella is the name of the character. And so Ella had learned to step in and out of grief, to sample it on demand. She didn't seek to block it out entirely, because the poignancy was among the few rewards of the job. It was a strange way to make a living, the slow creep of hours, the tedium of domesticity and isolation, morning talk shows bleeding into drowsy afternoon soaps, all pierced with looming mortality and surreal delusions. It's beautifully written. And it really grabbed me, I think, because A, you don't know what's going to happen. And she becomes, of course, more and more attached to the family as she's there. And I won't give away the end of the book, but she, as much as I'd like to, I won't. Because it tells the story of her time with that family and how deeply she impacts them and how deeply they impact her. It's called Say by Lila Savage, a beautiful meditation.
And like you say, it's not a big book. So it is, you could read this.
You can read this in a day. Yes. Yeah. All right. Absolutely.
Vicky.
Oh, Exhalation by David Chang. It's a group of short stories, science fiction, which I hesitate to mention because I think when people hear science fiction, they go, oh, I don't read science fiction. Oh,
unless they do.
Oh, but they should.
Unless it's The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell.
Yeah, that's, yes, that's a wonderful book, but there's more out there.
Yeah. And anyways, I thought the writing was brilliant. The stories you just have to read over and over again. This was recommended by Kathy on our staff. And I wanted to read a little review. It was also on President Obama's list of recommended reads. And he wrote, Exhalation by Ted Chang is a collection of short stories that will make you think, grapple with big questions, and feel more human. The best kind of science fiction. It's been called exquisite. I totally agree with that. And I think he looks at the big questions of the universe. He looks at the machinery and all the science fiction aspects, but it's very much on a personal level. Mm. So highly recommend.
And again, the title and author?
This is Exhalation by Ted Chang.
All right. Petra.
Well, first I have to say that I feel like I fail as a nerd because I haven't read Exhalation. part of the joy and difficulty of my job is that I have to read so many books to prepare for work events and panels and things that sometimes I don't get to read the things I want to read.
It's hard. That's,
oh gosh, what a terrible problem to have.
And I think that's why we like these lists so much. We may not always agree with them. I love your list, the Concierge. And it inspires us to read more and read in different areas than we would normally.
Right.
Well, good. That's exactly what I wanted to do. And actually, you know, I find things in there that I hadn't known about before either. It's a discovery tool for me too.
Well, and I have to say the other thing about that Concierge list is that we actually have a display in the library based on that, which we keep filling up at the end of a stack. And they are some of the most in-demand books. Yeah. And nobody's ever read them before, but they see NPR Concierge and they're like, oh, it must be good. And,
it makes me so happy.
And often it is really great. And it's interesting because we do it for fiction, and now I'm thinking, gosh, we should have it for nonfiction too.
There's so much,
because you have so much. Yeah.
I was going to talk about a romance novel because I feel like I should, but and there's some good ones in the Concierge. But now that you're mentioning nonfiction, one of my favorite discoveries in the Concierge this year was One Day by Gene Weingarten. Mm-hmm. Now he was, I think, a features editor or something like that at the Washington Post for many years. And one of the things that he used to do with his writers was challenge them to find stories everywhere. Like he would have them hammer a nail through a phone book, and whoever name it stopped on, you would have to write a story about it. So One Day, he's taking this principle for himself, and he had people draw a random date out of a hat. And that date, I think, was December 20th, 1986. So that's just a nothing date, right? It was a Sunday. It was between New Year's and Christmas when nothing happens. And he combed through all of the newspapers from that one day, and he pulled out all these unbelievable stories. And, you know, they're the kinds of things, there's a couple of reasonably large national news items in there, but they're mostly just small personal stories. Some of them are tragedies, some of them are love stories, some of them are, you know, terrible crimes, some of them are just, wow, that's interesting. And he writes about them with this novelistic grace that just takes these everyday little stories and elevates them and makes them universal. I mean, I picked it up at 7 p.m. and ripped through it and put it down at 1 a.m. That's how good it is. And that was a book I found through the concierge. So One Day by Jean Weingarten. It is amazing.
Yeah. Since we're talking nonfiction, which is my preferred reading is nonfiction. I do read some fiction, but I'm going to throw out there Mitch Zuckoff's book, Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. He does an amazing job. It's depressing, yes, but it's also inspiring. He tells the story, you know, people's stories who you may not have heard before. Some of these people have never talked about their stories before, and you really kind of you don't, as you're reading along, you don't know who's going to survive and who's, and it reminds us, basically documenting the history of that day from so many different angles. He did an amazing research in this book. It's a big book, and that was one I could not put it down. The Sydney Morning Herald says inspiring, depressing, heartbreaking, and simply astonishing. It is definitely worth reading and you know, documenting the day so we never forget, you know. So Mitchell Zuckoff's book is Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. Jill.
All right. Well, you know, I have to mention this one because you may all know that it's not every day that you get into an index of a book as well as into the acknowledgments. But this happens to be a year where I was both in the index and the acknowledgments of this biography by Mark Derry of Edward Gorey called Born to Be Posthumous, The Eccentric Life and Mysterious Genius of Edward Gorey. I had great pleasure of also interviewing Mark for this show.
That's right.
And I will say, though, there's a lot in here if you are a Gorey fan. If you're not a Gorey fan, if you love Cape Cod, there's a fair amount about Cape Cod. In fact, in the index, one of my favorite, I love reading. You know, this is part of my reference librarian life. I love looking at indexes and seeing how they categorize books. And in this case, there's a whole subject index on cats, because, of course, Edward really loved his cats. And cats on Cape Cod, more specifically. So if you're living on Cape Cod and you want to know about Edward Gorey's cats, this is the book for you.
I have never seen so many sticky notes in a
book.
Oh,
well, you know
before,
what? This has
Jill?
A trillion sticky notes in it, because I didn't. This was when I was interviewing Mark, so I didn't know where we would be going with that interview, which is why you can see I was prepared.
Yes.
Anyway, it's also I learned a lot of things. I was in puppet shows and theater pieces with Edward Gorey, and I learned a lot about Edward that I didn't know. He's a really private person. I'm sure he was rolling in his grave to know somebody was writing a biography on him, but I think Mark did a good job at trying to capture who Edward was without being able to really know. I think fundamentally it's really hard to know who Edward was, but Mark gives it a good try. Mm. And the book is, again, a biography of Edward Gorey, Born to Be Posthumous, The Eccentric Life and Mysterious Genius of Edward Gorey by Mark Derry.
Hey. Vicki.
Well, the next one I picked out was just one of those books that I don't know why it stuck in my brain. It's called The Salt Path by Rainer Wynn. It's the story of a couple in England who, through no fault of their own, lose their home and their livelihood, their farm, within days of finding out that the husband has just contracted a terminal illness. So what do you do? Mm-hmm. They, true story, they decide to walk the salt path, or the path along the coast of England, 630 miles. They are not hikers. They were not particularly outdoor people, but they found themselves with almost no options, weren't going to feel sorry for themselves particularly, though they were facing stunning news. And we follow their journey. Mm-hmm. I like the writing. It was a great story. I think we're intrigued by the idea of walking the coast and seeing the things that they saw, but learning more about them as a couple and how they stuck together. And I won't give away anything about the ending, but, but a great read, The Salt Path by Rainer Wynn.
All right. Petra.
All right. Well, I am going to recommend a romance now. I love romance. It is not something to be ashamed of. So there's an author called K.J. Charles. She writes a lot of queer historical romance. And this year she had a book called Any Old Diamonds, which is, I forget exactly when it's set, but it's sort of Victorian Edwardian. And it's about the estranged son of a duke. And the duke is a nasty piece of work. Cause sometimes, you know, ducal fathers in romance novels generally are. And so he wants to stick it to his father, so he hires a pair of jewel thieves to steal a diamond parure belonging to his father's second wife. And of course, he falls for one of the jewel thieves. And it again, it is a wonderfully evocative world. But the thing that I love about K.J. Charles's work is that she creates these situations where the conflict in the book, you know, romance is generally about two people growing to be worthy of each other, and she is really able to create believable character arcs in that way. A lot of times, you know, there's tropes in romance, and one of my least favorite ones is the big misunderstanding, which you're probably familiar. It goes all the way back to Shakespeare, right? If you think about Much Ado About Nothing, you know, Claudio sees the maid at the window and goes, "Oh, that's my fiance. I'm going to pitch a big man baby fit at the wedding and cause all this trouble because I can't be bothered to figure out what's really going on." K.J. Charles's books are, you know, she occasionally there are misunderstandings that come up, but then people talk about them like grownups. And honestly, what's almost attractive as the love story is watching people work out their issues with each other in grown up and mature ways. And you just read it and you go, God, I want that for myself. So, Any Old Diamonds. It's about jewel thieves. It's delightful.
Right.
K.J. Charles. All of her stuff is good, but this one just happened to have just come out.
Right. We're talking with Petra Mayer, editor at NPR Books. Vicky Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. And we are talking about favorite books of 2019. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to add to the list. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. And you're listening to The Point. We are talking about favorite books of 2019 with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, Vicky Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich, and joining us from NPR in Washington, D.C. is Petra Mayer. She's the editor at NPR Books. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. If there's a book that came out in 2019 that you would like to recommend to the world, this is your chance. Jill, what have you got next on yours?
Well, I felt I had to bring a couple of picture books. And I think just because they're our youngest readers, they too deserve a suggestion for a book. And so I asked our children's librarian, what book did you really love this year? Can you tell me just one book? And without hesitating for a moment, she said, River by Elijah Cooper. So I checked out River by Elijah Cooper, and it is indeed a beautiful book. And it can be used with, I think, a lot of different ages because, in fact, the illustrations are so beautiful. Mm. You could use it just to look at the pictures. But the text is about this mother who, at the beginning of the book, and actually before, the other curious thing about this is that when you open the book, you have your title page, but the story actually starts to the left of the title page, which seems sort of unusual to me and beautiful. And it's the mother showing her kids this map because the map is of the Hudson River, and she has decided she is going to canoe for the entire, from the Adirondacks to New York City, in a canoe by herself. And so it is this great adventure that their mother is having. And at the very beginning, it begins with her in her canoe sort of saying goodbye to the family on the shoreline. And the writing is, morning, a mountain lake, a traveler, a canoe. As she paddles out into the blustery middle of the lake, she turns for a last wave to the shore behind her. Her journey begins. And it follows her through the entire course, and there are storms, and it talks about how she gets food, and she's camping. But it is... And of course, I'm happy to report, has a happy ending. And she does get home again. And apparently, the author has never actually done this, but she claims she knows there are people that have done this, which is to canoe all the way from the Adirondacks to New York City. And it's a beautiful tale of nature and courage and strength and leaving your family because you need to leave your family, but then coming back and being so happy. And at the end, in the end pages, she's showing them where she's gone on the map after having shown them at the beginning where she was planning to go. And it also has a sort of great history at the end about the Hudson River for the adults that might be reading the book with their kids. So I really thought it was beautiful, as did our children's librarian. It's called River by Elisha Cooper. And the other children's book I brought along is called Small in the City by Sydney Smith, which was recommended by a friend of mine. And it just broke my heart and also is a beautifully illustrated book. This is apparently is his first picture book that he's done, the illustrations and the text. And there's very little text, actually, in this book. But you see this child getting off a bus and going into the city. And he keeps talking about the city. And it's like he's talking to somebody, but you don't really know. And somebody who's lost, but you don't really know right away who it is that's lost. Well, it turns out, in fact, it is his cat that is lost in the city. But the good news is, I will tell the end of this book.
Okay.
Yeah, it ends okay. Everything ends okay. At the very end, you can see that the cat's tracks, footprints have come back to the house. And so you know the cat has returned. So even though you're in horror that the cat is not going to come to a good end by the end, and it's beautifully drawn and beautifully written. And here's just one little bit from it. I know you like to listen to music. In the blue house down the street, someone's always playing piano, and there's a choir that practices in the red brick church. You could perch on the window ledge. So he's trying to tell the cat all these things that the cat could do to help himself. And you could go to the fish store, and you could hide here, and you can go down an alley here. It's lovely, lovely story. And again, it has a happy ending. Mm-hmm. Small in the City by Sydney Smith.
All right, Vicki.
Children's books are wonderful,
aren't
they? And I love working in a bookstore because I have an excuse to read children's books. So I'd love to mention a couple that my favorites this year. One is called Shouting at the Rain by Linda Mullaly Hunt. She wrote one for the Murphys and Fish in a Tree. It's so popular with children. This is a story solidly set on Cape Cod, and it's about a young girl who lives with her grandmother, who's quirky and wonderful and loves her granddaughter. And it's about friendship. It's about finding family. It's about adults who have made mistakes in their past, who correct them. I think the tone is pitch perfect. I just loved it.
What age range would that be?
Age range, I would say about ideally maybe 10. They may say 9 to about 13.
Yeah.
When you're really looking at growing up and finding your family and finding those you want around you. That's Shouting at the Rain by Linda Mullaly Hunt. And another one that I adored is called The Line Tender, L-I-N-E, Tender, by Kate Allen. It's about a young girl whose mother died when she was 8. She's now about 12 or 13. Her mother was a shark scientist. So you learn so much about sharks in this book. It's profoundly sad. Something happens in the book. I had the one most wonderful discussion with my granddaughter about why that made her so sad, as opposed to maybe some of those books like those Maze Runner fantasies was filled with violence and death and everything. She was so incredibly moved by this too, and I think the writing's wonderful. The Line Tender by Kate Allen.
All right. Petra.
Can I recommend something that wasn't in the concierge?
Yes, please.
When we were talking about this, you asked me if I had anything that was a favorite that wasn't in the concierge. And in the moment, I couldn't think of something because the book that I was thinking of, I had forgotten it wasn't in the concierge. So this is actually a book. I was lucky enough to do an interview with the author. It's called Mudlarking by Lara Makelam. And she is a British writer whose hobby is mudlarking. And this is an occupation that goes back centuries. Now it's a hobby. Back in the day, it was a way to make a living of people picking around in the mud on the foreshore of the River Thames. So the actual Victorian mudlarks were these poor kids who would sort of try to scavenge a living out of the mud. But nowadays, people just kind of go, they walk down there and pick around and look for bits of history. And so I actually got to go down there onto the foreshore of the Thames with her and look around. And so the book is it's a journey down the Thames from sort of the headwaters to the estuary and all the various things that you find on the shores along the way. And from each individual artifact, she can spin out this whole sort of history of a moment or a place. And one of the things that she loves and that I actually found a bunch of when I was picking around on the river with her is pins, because there's tons of them and they wash down onto the riverbank and you can pick them up and they're all handmade. And you, when you think about why they're there, it's because, you know, if you imagine, you know, all those portraits of Elizabethan era nobles with the huge ruffs, all of that stuff was pinned, like they were pinned into their clothing. So everybody had hundreds and hundreds of pins, and now they've just washed down onto the riverbank and you can pick them up. And there's that, you know, it's a little microcosm of all that history. And we found, you know, I found medieval pottery and I picked this thing up and it was sort of green glazed. And she said to me, "You're the first person to touch that since it went into the river."
Ooh.
And
Wow.
I can feel my brain exploding. The book itself is sort of that experience encapsulated. And it's beautifully written. It's very evocative. And it also, you know, she's not a historian herself, but she brings in all this expertise. She has a Facebook group where people post their finds, things that they found in the river, and then various historians weigh in. You know, she works with various university and museum historians. So you get a real background on some of the things that she's found that really paints a picture of sort of the everyday history. Because when you look at portraits and when you look at history books, you know, you don't get the lives of the everyday people. But when you're picking around on the Thames and you're finding roof tiles, and, you know, I found one and she said, "Oh, that predates the Fire of London. You can tell because the hole for the peg is square." Oh my God.
I have to, this is a librarian question, but was this published in the UK or has it been published in the US?
It came out here in September.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Glad to know that in case we don't
absolutely.
Have it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, we try not to cover books that aren't actually out in the US. But that's Mudlarking by Lara Makelam. It is just absolutely wonderful journey sort of along the Thames and through British history.
Janet sent us an email. She says, "This may not be a new book, but I thoroughly enjoyed it as it was set on Penicuis Island," and that's Lauren Wolk's Beyond the Bright Sea. Not new, but yes. Kind of almost new,
absolutely.
Right?
Yes, new enough.
I think 2018 new-ish. Instead of 2019.
And worthy.
And so definitely worthy. Worth a read. That was a great book. So thanks for that suggestion, Janet. Jill.
I have brought back a book I did talk about at some point during the last year, which I very much enjoyed. It's called Figuring by Maria Popova. And I'm still going back to it because of its depth and because she has so many little stories in this. She explains what she's doing here, but she is basically talking about all these various women and how they're connected to science and the arts. Among them are the astronomer Maria Mitchell, who, of course, many of us know from her time on Nantucket, who paved the way for women in science, the sculptor Harriet Hosmer, who did the same in art, the journalist and literary critic Margaret Fuller, who sparked the feminist movement, and the poet Emily Dickinson. And they're all sort of woven together, but it also has a huge section on marine biologist Rachel Carson, who, again, we, of course, here in Woods Hole have a statue sitting by the water of Rachel Carson. We have strong feelings for her. And it talks about this group of artists and writers and scientists and how they all interacted with one another. And it's very slow going in some ways. I read it when I was actually on vacation, which I think is a good way to read it so that you aren't interrupted. Put all your devices far away. Otherwise, you'll be wanting to check everything she says as you're reading, which is not a good idea for reading this book. Just let yourself drop into it and you will learn so much about these particular women, but just her way of connecting things together that you would not necessarily have connected. And just the stuff on Maria Mitchell alone, it makes it a great read. It's called Figuring by Maria Popova.
All right. Vicki.
History. It's been a good year for history. So I thought I'd talk about a couple of new books. One is by one of my very favorite authors, David McCullough, his book Pioneers, The Historic Story of the Settlers Who Brought the American Ideal West. I think more than almost any other historian, he makes you go back in history and live it, go along for the journey. This book, it starts off, I just have to read a little bit, in how he does that. This is about the settling of the Ohio Valley, four middle western states, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin. from the late 18th century to about the 1860s. And he starts, "Never before, as he knew, had any of his countrymen set off to accomplish anything like what he had agreed to undertake. A mission that, should he succeed, could change the course of history in innumerable ways and to the long-lasting benefit of countless Americans. That he had no experience, prior experience in such a venture and was heading off alone in his own one-horse shay appears to have been little concern." And it goes on. Mm-hmm. So I think his research is wonderful, and like anyone who really knows the subject, he makes it understandable,
comes alive,
relatable.
Yeah,
it just totally comes alive.
Yeah, he's definitely got a way of making history. It's not boring at all.
And we see it through our eyes, through their eyes. But another one I had to mention, particularly being on the Cape Cod, is David Silverman's This Land Is Their Land.
That's an excellent book.
Yes.
His research is excellent.
Amazing. Yeah. It's The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And as we approach the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Pilgrims, this gives a more accurate view and view from the Native people.
That's so true.
Highly recommended.
All right, Petra.
Ooh, hang on a second. I was looking at my notes and got distracted. the last book I want to talk about is kind of a bummer, but it's so good. Since we're on a nonfiction trip right now, I don't know if any of you saw that HBO miniseries on Chernobyl earlier this year.
No.
It was intense. And if you did see it, for people out there who saw it and want to know more, there's an amazing book called Midnight in Chernobyl, and I'm about to look up the author because I have spaced out his name. It's a big fat book, because the thing about the series is it's very dramatic, it's very well acted, but they had to condense a lot and sort of condense a lot of characters to sort of get it to fit into a TV structure. But this book makes you understand the amazing scope of what was going on, because there's just so much that you have to understand to get to that moment of the actual explosion. And this book is just brilliant at picking out sort of, you know, you have to know about Soviet central economic planning, and you have to know about the various warring agencies that developed the reactor design and which one won and why the reactors were built the way they were. You have to understand a little bit about nuclear physics. And I am not a scientist, but I found it's by Adam Higginbotham. I just looked it up. Midnight in Chernobyl really takes all of the pieces of this incredibly huge story and picks them apart and digests them so that you can understand everything that's going on. It is not a cheerful book by any means, but it is fascinating and very well told.
All right. Jill.
Well, I have to say, I asked friends things they loved. And this one I just have to mention because I love so much what my friend wrote about this book. It's Allie Smith's novel, Spring. She's been doing a whole series. There are going to be four of them. She's done fall, winter. They're novels, sort of. I mean, they are novels, but they're also beautifully written. And my friend wrote, "I loved Allie Smith's Spring through and through. I love her imagination, her heart, her stylistic invention that is at once remarkable and also inviting. I love the way she always introduces me to artists I didn't know before and am thrilled to get to know. And I love the way she is intellectual but not show-offish, as if she used to operate solely from her head, but has in recent years let her heart take an equal role in her writing." Mm. And that alone makes me want to read this book and start at the beginning with fall. But this one is, the newest one is Spring, a novel.
All right. And we should say that we will have a link with a list of all of the books we talked about today at our website, capeandislands.org. And also we'll have a link to the NPR book, A Concierge, so you won't miss out on anything and get lots of ideas. Petra Mayer, thanks so much for joining us. We enjoyed
Absolutely
having you this
my
month.
Pleasure.
Editor at
Thank
NPR
you.
Books, and Vicki Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop and Sandwich, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank
Happy
you.
New Year.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.